The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone. Welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you live from the studios of WWDB in Greater Philadelphia, AM 860, and streaming live on WWDBAM.com, Boomer Generation Radio. You can reach us with ideas or suggestions by dropping us an email at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. We have a very interesting show for you today, both of our segments. We want to welcome to the microphones of Boomer Generation Radio for this first half hour, Dr. Robert Singer, the Section Chief of Cardiology at Virtua West Jersey Health Systems. Dr. Robert Singer, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you. Nice to see you. We want to talk a little bit about, well, we want to talk a lot about your specialty of cardiology and heart health and how it impacts our generation, baby boomers and their families. And what we're being told all the time in the media is that heart issues are still the number one cause of death in the United States of America. You're on the front lines. Give us a very, very quick update, if you can. What's the progress on heart health in this country, and how are we beginning to deal with this statistic, this overwhelmingly frightening statistic?
Well, despite the large advances that have been made over the last 10 to 15 years, cardiovascular disease is still the leading cause of death in those over 60 years old, which is of great concern to baby boomers. We've made great strides in invasive cardiology, putting stents in where before we only used balloon angioplasty, keeping people's arteries open. And we've made large strides in preventing cardiovascular disease, including stroke and heart attack, by using statins and realizing that certain things in our diet are not good for us. Things like trans fats that are being banned in certain parts of the country. There are also new guidelines that have come out for lipids, which will put more people on statins across the country. And then there's the overwhelming need and the overwhelming thought process that people need to exercise. They need to use their bodies. They need to become active and try to prevent comorbidities such as diabetes, which is also huge in the baby boomer population.
Really? So we read all the time. I don't think there's a day or at least a week that goes by in any of the newspapers or magazines that I get for the aging issues and baby boomer issues that there's not another article about diet and exercise and diet and exercise and diet and exercise, to the point where one senses that if one spent 8 hours a day at the gym and ate nuts and tree bark, you would live forever.
Absolutely. That's all we hear about. And we have to use our common sense. Right now, the American Heart Association guidelines say that you should do 30 minutes of moderately intense activity at least 5 days per week, or at least 25 minutes of vigorous activity at least 3 days a week. That and also muscle strength training twice a week.
Is that weights? When you say muscle, lifting weights or some
stretching.
Sort of, okay.
So what I usually tell my patients who are just starting to exercise is get out and walk. Just get out there and walk for 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week, without stopping. People like to walk their dogs, but the dogs stop. We want you to keep walking for 30 minutes constantly, and not only do it during the warm weather months, but also get inside, go to a mall, join a gym, and do some walking, maybe a stationary bike, for 30 minutes at least 5 days a week. That's a place to start. With all the exercise craze, we don't want patients to be hurting themselves and start exercising by jogging or running or lifting heavy weights. You could really hurt yourself that way. And how many patients have I seen who have hurt their knees or their hips and now require orthopedic surgery because they've been exercising?
Yeah, I know. My knees and my ankles tell me that just about 5 or 6 days a week. One of the things I see, and I just occurred because I just heard this again, another report on this morning on the drive over to the station. Are you seeing a lot more, and do you recommend these electronic bands that keep track of exercise or heart rates? Or
boy, isn't that the craze nowadays?
Is this a gimmick, or is this really helpful?
For certain patients who are in good shape, I think it is helpful. But what I tell patients when they ask me about these devices, say just go out there and sweat. Let your body tell you. You're starting to exercise. Get out there and give a good sweat for 30 minutes. That's what I'd like to say. I'm not so much concerned about the heart rate, because if people limit their exercise because their heart rate gets too high, then they won't be exercising.
Is there an ideal heart rate, a resting heart rate? Is there?
It varies. There are some people who think that to exercise at around 70 to 80% of your predicted maximal heart rate is good. But patients are on drugs that may limit their heart rates from getting up. They may never get to that, or they may get much higher and therefore won't get in a good workout.
So the statin thing, just for one quick thing before, and I also want to pick your brain about this internet stuff too, as long as we're on electronic, because I know I see people all the time and they'll say they'll come back from the doctor and say, I went online and I have the entire answer to everything because I researched it on the internet. I'm going to show this to my doctor so that the doctor will know what's going on, as if the doctor never went to medical school.
Statins are great drugs. Over the years, they've reduced cardiovascular events. Millions of people have been helped by these drugs. Can they cause side effects? Absolutely. And unfortunately, if you look online, you hear that it can cause liver problems, cognitive problems. But the fact of the matter is, for the majority of people, statins are helpful if you need them. And the four groups that benefit the most are those with prior cardiovascular disease, if you've had a stroke or a heart attack before, if your LDL cholesterol is extremely high, if you have diabetes, that's a reason to be on a statin. And also if what they call your risk factor for 10-year risk is over 7.5%, then you should be on a statin also. But there are lots of things out on the internet how these drugs are bad for you. They are not bad for you. They can cause an occasional person aches and pains. And I would recommend speaking to your physician who started you on the medication what you could do to feel better. Maybe try another statin. Maybe decrease the dosage. Maybe go off for a week and go back on it. These are some of the ways we get around some of the side effects for statins.
The LDL is the bad, so-called the bad cholesterol, correct?
The LDL is the bad cholesterol, and the HDL is the good cholesterol. And you want the HDL as high as possible.
And is there an LDL number that if it comes back on your annual physical that you should, like, run screaming to the cardiologist saying, uh-oh?
Well, certainly the new guidelines say if your LDL is greater than 190. But of interest, the old guidelines said that if your LDL was greater than 100, that was elevated. I think physicians nowadays are easing into the new guidelines, and a lot of this has to do with family history and other risk factors. Your care has to be individualized. Are you a smoker? Are you greatly overweight? Do you lead a sedentary lifestyle? Do you have a strong family history for cardiovascular disease? Well, if your LDL is 140, perhaps you do need a statin then.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Singer here on Boomer Generation Radio, cardiologist and section chief from the Virtua West Jersey Health Systems, here on Boomer Generation Radio about issues surrounding heart and heart health. And we do have a call-in number if you are so motivated to perhaps ask a question. It's 610-664-4100. That's 610-664-4100. Again, you're on Boomer Generation Radio and WWDBAM860, WWDBAM.com. Dr. Singer, you mentioned this whole idea of family history. And I really want to ask you about this because the older I get and the more I seem to read and put a lot more stock in the role of genetics and the role of your family and the role of that family history. Could you just comment on your perception and your experience? How real important is that?
As I tell my patients, the apple just doesn't fall far from the tree. I usually ask two types of questions. Has anyone passed away from cardiovascular disease early in life before they were 55? And then the next question is, when they did pass away, what did they pass away from? If they're in their 70s or 80s or 90s, did they have heart attacks or strokes? If the answers are yes to that, I tend to be more aggressive with these patients. Try to get them on statins earlier. Try to get them on aspirin at either age 55 or 60, depending on male or female. And it's working with the patient to see how you could limit their risk factors. What was it in their parents? Maybe their parents were smokers. Mm-hmm. The patient's a smoker. Obviously, that's something that they need to stop immediately.
I mean, let's just make sure we just reinforce the fact that if you smoke, it's really stupid.
It's not good.
I mean, to put it bluntly.
It's interesting. There are patients out there who continue to smoke, believe it or not. And we have long conversations. And occasionally I'll get a patient who will just say, I want to smoke. Leave me alone. And you have to respect that. But you also have to say that they are at much higher risk for cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, peripheral arterial disease. And they do develop it after a while. But it's a very expensive habit. It's expensive for them. It's expensive for the health system. And no good comes of it.
So this family history thing, that's good. You see this, you tell people that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It's easy for you to say. How do people react to that? I would imagine that when somebody sits in your office and they look at their family history and they're maybe presenting some initial symptoms, there's a significant amount of fear.
There's fear, but it's usually something that the patient has thought about. Gee, mom had a heart attack, or dad had a heart attack, my uncle had a heart attack, my other uncle had a heart attack. They usually know it, but you're bringing it to the surface when you're speaking to them, and then they can acknowledge it and say, okay, now we can move forward. And you develop a treatment plan for that patient. But the family history, I think, is the number one risk factor. And it should be said that not everyone with high cholesterol has a heart attack or stroke.
Mm-hmm.
But it also needs to be said that not everyone with a low cholesterol or a normal cholesterol doesn't have a heart attack or a stroke. And that's where family history, I think, comes into play.
So that always reminds me of I can't remember his name right now, the Jim Fix, I think.
Yes.
The joys of running and lean and mean and drops dead of a heart attack. I'm sure you see these situations all the time. There's a lot of a family history component in that. Is there?
Absolutely. But there are also fluke events that happen. A heart attack happens when a plaque ruptures and breaks. So you could have a stress test. You could be running all the time, but all you need is one little fatty plaque and the right milieu, and the plaque breaks and a heart attack happens.
So we're talking with Dr. Robert Singer, Section Chief of Cardiology for the Virtua West Jersey Health Systems. And we'll be back with Dr. Singer in a minute. But I do want to bring you up to date again at one of our friends that supporters of Boomer Generation Radio, Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice. And they've asked me to remind you, if you've ever felt worried about your parents' failing memory or concerned about your parents' safety at home and not sure where to turn for help, if you've answered yes to these, we recommend you contact SeniorWise. SeniorWise is here for you. This is a geriatric care managing program that can provide assistance and in a comprehensive assessment and a care plan development that help keep your loved ones safe at home. SeniorWise geriatric care managers can help screen and monitor in-home services, help you avoid costly mistakes, and ease your loved one's transition to a care facility if that becomes necessary. SeniorWise is a member of the Samaritan Family of Services, and to speak with a SeniorWise geriatric care manager today, call them at 856-552-5166. That's 856-552-5166. Log on to www.seniorwisecare.org. That's www.seniorwisecare.org. And that phone number again is 856-552-5166. Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice, mentioned that you heard about them on Boomer Generation Radio, and will be they'll be more than happy to take care of you. Really good people, really good people. We just did a major program with them last week, and they're there to help you out. And this is a tough time when you have to make these decisions about a loved one and facility placement, etc. Dr. Robert Singer, we're back with you, the Section Chief of Cardiology at Virtua West Jersey Healthcare Systems. We're talking about family of origin issues. You mentioned aspirin. It's in the news all the time. Do you tell everybody to take that little baby aspirin once a day?
I don't tell everybody. Again, I look at the patient. Is there a family history? Are there risk factors? Does the patient have diabetes? How is their cholesterol? Right now, what I'm using is LDLs greater than 100 in a patient, LDL cholesterol in a patient who is a man greater than 55. I'll ask them to consider a baby aspirin on a daily basis, which is an 81 milligram aspirin. And for a woman greater than 65, there have been studies shown in the Women's Health Study I believe it was, in women between 55 and 65, aspirin wasn't recommended because there was a larger amount of problems with patients' stomachs. So they advise aspirin for women at risk for those greater than 65 years of age.
And I have to ask you just to follow up something we just talked a little bit about before the show, and that's the difference in men and women and how they present heart issues. In the popular press, and I think I'm not too far off in this perception, there seems to be this reporting that women will present very differently with heart issues than men do. So I want to know if that's your experience. And the follow-up question to that is, do you see a greater resistance on the part of men to undertake serious approaches to heart health?
That's a very interesting question. The first part, remind me the first part again.
The first part is the difference between men and women.
Yes.
And, yes.
There have been studies showing that women have differences in the way they present with cardiovascular disease, coronary insufficiency, otherwise known as angina, when you have blockages in the coronary arteries. In my practice, I find that you have to listen to each patient and it has to be individualized because men sometimes present with very atypical symptoms, as do women. Patients could present with pains in their wrist or hand, pain across or discomfort across the upper shoulders. We may be asking about pain, but the patient says, I don't have any pain. I have a little discomfort, though. And there's patients take that differently. It could be shortness of breath. It seems that women present more frequently with shortness of breath and not so much with the classical chest pressure or chest tightness. But men also present with very atypical symptoms also. And the take-home message is that every patient, no matter man or female, you have to discuss it with them. What's different? What's changed? Go over the risk factors and add it all up to see if further testing is indicated. As far as the second question, it seems that that women accept medications easier than men do. I'm not sure whether or not it's a macho thing or not, but overall, women will take medications and won't be upset about it, where a man the first time around will be very, when they're put on the first medication, will be more resistant.
Really? Why? Why do you think?
I'm not sure whether or not women are used to being on medications such as oral contraceptives early on and accept medications where men don't have that until they get into their 50s, 40s or 50s. That may be one reason, but I don't have a good explanation otherwise.
That's just something that I try to figure out some people to talk to about that. I don't know whether, like you said, it is a macho thing or just this a subtle, not so subtle reminder of you're growing older and all the theory, not the theory, that, you know, the statistics. So you if you're a man, you're going to die earlier. Is that the fear factor? I don't know. I'm just speculating.
There are some men who just feel that they are tough as nails and they don't want to touch anything. But I don't see that as much in women. You know, if you
really
want to talk about gender differences.
Do you suggest, I mean, people have been it's suggested to them to have an annual physical. Do you also recommend an annual heart? You know, somebody goes to their family physician, they get their physical, they come back, things are okay. Then do you suggest then you should also come to the cardiologist and get an annual heart physical?
That's actually not recommended. What we do recommend is that you go to your family physician and you go over cardiovascular issues. You go over lipids, family history, and other risk factors. And this is especially difficult for women because women are in their 50s or 60s, the first talk may not be about cardiovascular health, which again is the leading killer. It may be about perimenopausal symptoms. It may be about breast cancer. It may be about osteoporosis because there's still that feeling out there somewhere that cardiovascular disease is a man's disease and not a woman's disease. Hmm. So sometimes women can be undertreated just because it's not discussed and they may not have their problems found as quickly as men do.
Well, I know next week on this slot, we're going to be bringing in somebody who, Natalie, who's really comes from an expertise dealing with women's health issues. So if you see her, you may want to mention
Absolutely.
The fact that we want to pick that up next week, just in case you happen to run into her on the odd moment here every once between now and next Tuesday. There's one issue before we start running out of time that I really do want to raise with you, because we've had some conversations about this on one foot off and on. And that is, look, you're a cardiologist. You deal with some extremely difficult situations, end-of-life situations. Could you just comment from your perspective of the role of faith, the role of spirituality in these situations? Is it helpful? Does it ever come up? Do you ever find yourself in the role of spiritual counselor?
I think it comes up extremely often, probably once a day.
Really?
Where I will be speaking to family of a very sick patient or speaking to the sick patient and trying to draw out of them what they want in their final years. You may have patients in their 90s. And there are all types of patients. There are those that just want everything done, even though it may be, I wouldn't say futile, but it may be worsening their quality of life in the few years that they have left. There are those who are quite at ease with their final years, and they say, just make me comfortable. And again, those who say, do everything you possibly can. It's very interesting trying to draw out the patient where they are at that point in time. There are those who are comfortable with the aging process and comfortable in their final days being what they are. And those who seek to feel like they did when they were in their 40s and 50s. Doctor, why is it that I have aches and pains all over? And they're 93 years old, riddled with arthritis. I don't like feeling this way. Do something. It's difficult.
Do you still get that? I guess you do, but what you just said, this concept of you're the doctor, you can fix it?
Absolutely. And you know something? We could fix a lot of things, but sometimes the cure is worse than the disease.
And how does that make you feel as a physician? I mean, I'm always fascinated to talk to my friends who are docs about, and you know, we're sitting around and who you know, there's such a perception placed upon the physician, but very little is an opportunity is for the physician to talk about how does this make me feel?
It's a great source of frustration, I believe, at least for me, and I believe for other physicians also, where you have patients where you just can't do a lot for in cardiology, maybe end-stage congestive heart failure, where you have to speak to the family, you have to speak to the patient and say, we can't do much more in this 86 or 87-year-old patient with a very, very weak heart. And it's actually very rewarding when the family comes back and gets it. They understand and the patient understands, and you can send them on to people who will help them at home so they don't have the indignity of being in the hospital, but they could be treated at home, hospice care. And patients get shocked when they hear the word hospice.
Right.
But it's not like it was. It's really it's a wonderful service. But it's one of the most rewarding things when you could help somebody in their last few months, weeks, days be comfortable and be with their family and be happy.
And what about the role of that spirituality or faith in your soul when you're dealing with patients? I mean, there's a patient passes away and you try to do everything it's humanly possible and medically possible. There still has to be, I'm sure, some days that you go home and are just, you know,
it's called closing the door and crying for a while.
Really?
And come out and keep plugging away. Also very rewarding is when you get a card from the family saying, thank you for everything that you did. That's a wonderful thing. That's what it's all about for a physician. But it's quite difficult to have patients realize their age and the aging process and get them to realize that you don't have many more years to go. Let's set it up so you're comfortable and ready to go. And it's a slow process. You have to educate the patient and also get out from them what they're expecting.
And how many times do you have this conversation with the patient who you and he or she reach an understanding and the family comes in and says, we don't care what mom or dad wants, Dr. Singer, just do everything in your power?
That's not an uncommon thing, what we usually try to do is bring the family in. I beg the patients to bring their families in so that more than one set of ears can hear it, and so we're all on the same page. It's very difficult to deal with patients in their 80s and 90s alone without family in the room listening to what's going on. It's very difficult. Most of the time I'll pick up the phone and call the family, but it's even better when they're there where you could have this really a crucial conversation with family there and everyone is on the same page.
I'm neglected to ask you this one question that always bothers me in these conversations. So and we only have about a minute left in this segment. So I'll just, this is very unfair. I know, you know, but it's like, so for the baby boomer generation still, what's the role of stress in heart health? Does stress kill, like the old bumper sticker?
It certainly can. I mean, there are some actual disease processes, stress-induced cardiomyopathy, broken, which is the same thing as broken heart syndrome, which used to be called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. But overall, stress can increase inflammation in the body. But let's face it, there's stress out there. Everyone has stress, from the highest level executive to the lowest level executive. The person working at a fast food place to a person working at Citizens Bank ballpark. Everyone is under
or the bullpen.
Everyone is under a great deal of stress. So high levels of stress can cause some cardiovascular problems. But stress is a word that's thrown around out there. It's hard to tell exactly how much stress somebody is under. But I will say, how many times have I heard people coming in saying that I'm taking care of my kids, I'm unemployed, and I have to take care of my parents? Huge stress.
Dr. Robert Singer, the section chief of cardiology at the Virtual West Jersey Health Systems. I want to thank you. We're just about out of time for this segment. I really want to thank you for coming in and sharing your expertise and your soul with us this morning. And I hope we can get you back one day soon. So thank you very, very much. My best to the family and congratulations on your daughter's graduation from religious school last night.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here.
You take care. Take care. Say hello home. We want to also remind you of another good friend of the show, the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott. The Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott, which provides concierge financial consulting and planning services, using a formal investment process as their foundation, clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. There are no needs greater than your own when it comes to personal financial planning, and the Hecht Investment Group provides experience, guidance, and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. We ask you to contact the Hecht Investment Group toll-free at 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. Or visit thehechtinvestmentgroup.com. The Hecht Investment Group is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And Peter Hecht, we're happy to tell you, is recognized by Philadelphia Magazine and New Jersey Magazine as a 5-star wealth manager for 2013 and 2014. And Janney Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and the SIPC. That's the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott. And again, that toll-free number, 855-289-2168, and on the web at hechtinvestmentgroup.com. Thanks, Bob. Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, a reminder that if you want to reach us by email, it's boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. That's boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And if you want to ask the question of our next guest, Dr. Judith Curtin, a doctor of audiology and the owner of ABC Hearing Net. The call-in number in a couple of minutes is 610-664-4100. And we are very pleased to welcome to our show, Boomer Generation Radio, Dr. Judith Curtin. And we want to remind you that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services located in 8 states in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and near Midwest regions of the United States. Kendall advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential and is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit kendall.org or call toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. That's kendall.org. Dr. Judith Curtin, the owner of ABC Hearing Net, doctor of audiology, teacher at Westchester University, correct? Welcome to Boomer Generation Radio. We are going to talk about something that I would imagine a lot of boomer families and boomers themselves have dealt with or are starting to deal with, and that is aspects of hearing loss. And this may or may not be a reflection of too many rock concerts in the 60s or 70s or being married to earphones, but this is a real issue. I've seen it in my family, and I'm sure you see it all the time in your office. The NIH, the National Institutes of Health, have given us statistics. Just from your perspective, your profession, your practice, how prevalent is hearing loss amongst baby boomers?
Well, it's inevitable.
Inevitable?
It's inevitable.
Inevitable?
You will be seeing me someday.
That's okay. Goodbye.
Okay. First of all, I think people think it's an aging, you know, you have to be old to have hearing loss. And it doesn't. It happens very young. I would say 30% of the people in our practice are between the ages of 40 and 60 years of age.
How many? 30%?
About 30%.
Wow.
Okay. Hearing loss is very insidious, and it's hard to detect. The typical pattern of losing hearing, you first start to lose just a few sounds, like the S, the TH, the F, the K. And you think, that's not so bad, just missing a few sounds. But they're the grammatical tags of English, and they change the meaning of a word in a second. So people don't lose hearing, you know, flat out, all hearing. They lose clarity. And that's really the complaint that people have. It's just, it wasn't clear. Maybe it was the acoustics in the environment. Maybe in groups it was the noise, background noise was too loud. But that loss of clarity or missing the punchline, or not quite getting the movie details when people are talking, is the beginning of hearing loss. It doesn't mean you need a hearing aid, but you do need to have your hearing checked so that you're in charge of your hearing and that the hearing loss is not in charge of you.
And so the word inevitable, I'm still stuck on inevitable.
Sorry.
It woke me up. So this presents its, in other words, everybody, right? Everybody.
It's kind of like you need glasses at 40.
Mm-hmm.
I personally, if I could change anything, I would have a hearing test every 5 years once you hit 50.
Really?
Yeah. And I think because the repercussions of untreated hearing loss are so great.
Give me an example of...
Most people start thinking they're losing their memory function,
mm-hmm,
when it's only hearing loss.
Talk about the connection to that, yeah.
Well, when speech starts to be less clear to you, your brain has to take over. So if somebody said, I don't feel very well, I'm going to go upstairs and go to bed. Everybody thinks, she said, go to bed. But I didn't. I said, go to bed. And your brain starts filling in what it thinks belongs there. And you don't realize this is happening. The other side of it, too, is that you understand people one-on-one because your eyes start to hear. You know that expression, I hear better with my glasses on or mm-hmm, something like mm-hmm. that. That's just speech reading, which I teach at Westchester University, by the way. You start to supplement what you can't hear with your knowledge of language and with your vision. It's great because it works wonderfully, but it starts to take a toll on your cognitive skills. Your cognitive energy is being diverted to decipher a message rather than respond to a message. So it becomes more complicated taking in new information when you're trying to figure out, did they say this or did they really say this? You know, when you start mishearing things, they can be quite funny, but you have to give more than, you have to give 100% of your attention to somebody when you have, as you start to lose your hearing.
Do people get concerned that there's something, I think you alluded to this, a person's losing their hearing, they may just sort of like, they don't want to, they drift off, and will that perception be that there's something wrong mentally? I may not be expressing this correctly.
Well, the biggest fear in aging is your memory.
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
And knowing that, I find that people who have hearing loss attach it to memory function before they attach it to hearing loss.
Really?
And it's just such a simple, easy thing to fix. It takes a good hearing aid on the right ears. Not everybody is successful with hearing aids. It gives you 10 years, 10, 15 years back of your life easily.
Is there a lot of denial with this?
Well, you know, you had mentioned that earlier. Denial is one of those words that I just want to rip out of the books.
Okay, so I won't use it.
No. I want to explain it a little bit because that's where all the arguments come from.
Mm-hmm.
A person who has a hearing loss, like I said, loses clarity first. But if you say to them, you can't hear, they'll say, I can hear, you just don't speak clearly. And so every time you say you can't hear, they're going to support that fact because they actually do hear. They hear, oh, yeah, you know, what is it? So they're not hearing clearly. But if you said to them, you're not hearing me clearly, are you? They would say, no, I'm not. So the arguments that go on about hearing is, I describe to my students, it's like a beach ball. You know, when I'm holding a ball and the stripes are red and yellow and orange and blue, people are arguing over different things. I think when people are, quote, unaware, I would say unaware of the scope of their loss, a hearing impaired person is the last person to realize how blatantly obvious it is to everybody else and how much of a burden it is to everybody else when they're hearing impaired. Because you don't really own your disability until you get a hearing aid. Until then, you're quite handicapped.
So let's talk a little bit about the acquisition of hearing aids.
Good.
Okay. I mean, I know I'll personalize it. When my mom in her 80s, after a series of conversations, decided that we would go to the audiologist, and we had these conversations, and she got fitted with hearing aids, et cetera, et cetera. It was a major.
Did she wear them?
She wore them when she wanted to. And when it was convenient, or when it was convenient for her to forget to put them in, she did. I found that to be it's sometimes humorous and sometimes very very frustrating. But what's the tipping point? What's the tipping point? We all have people listening who may have mom or dad. They're taking care of them. They're noticing some of this. What you're talking about, mm-hmm. this lack of clarity, this sort of like concern about hearing. What's the tipping point where you have to say, okay, we're going to make that appointment to talk about the hearing aid? Or is there a tipping point?
There really is. I mean, and it's different for everybody. Usually it's some situation, usually a family gathering, where they missed everything. Or they were completely off topic and felt foolish. Once a person has that experience, then it's very easy for them to come into compliance. Everybody comes into my office terrified, absolutely terrified. And they walk out, I would say the majority of them, relieved and happy.
Terrified about what?
You know, it's really hard to wrap around. First of all, nobody wants a hearing aid. I don't want a hearing aid. I mean, it's just, you don't want it. But until they're face-to-face with the stress, you were talking about stress mm-hmm. and cardio issues, until they're face-to-face with the stress that hearing loss causes, and they experience the relief. And that's part of my job, is to take them where they are with the stress that the hearing loss is causing, show them the stress. I will do different things. I'll talk to them when they can't see my mouth. I'll talk to them at a normal conversational level. I'll do different things so that they can feel the energy that's being taken from them while they're listening. And then the relief that a hearing aid brings. And the hearing aid itself sells itself. The problem is you have to trust who you're dealing with. You have to be very comfortable with the person you choose to be your practitioner.
And
because you have to be able to complain, you know, if you, and you have to give it back. You have to be comfortable giving it back if it's not working for you.
The technology of hearing aids.
It's fabulous.
Could you just walk us through, because I'm sure the technology has changed from that old days in the movies with, you know, just a big, big thing. I've seen them. You can't see them.
No.
You can't see them.
No. Very few hearing aids can be seen today. And everybody cares how they look. I don't care if they're 102.
Right.
They want that hearing aid to be tiny. And they are. They have rechargeable hearing aids. We sell a hearing aid, the Lyric, that's completely in the ear. I change it every 2 months for somebody. It's a perfect hearing aid for somebody who can't manage batteries. You know, hearing aids have all this Bluetooth capability now. So you see people walking around with crickets in their ears, you know, on Bluetooth. You can have your cell phone talk to your hearing aids. The phone can answer.
Get out of here.
You press the button and you talk to your hearing aids. I mean, your hearing aids get the amplification in the shape and pattern it needs to hear clearly. In fact, you can go into an environment, and if you don't like that environment, you pull out your iPhone and you can adjust the microphone in your hearing aid to quiet down the background noise. So it's
they're pretty cool, sexy.
They really are. I mean, they're wonderful.
That's a far cry from.
And you know, people think this is the interesting thing about Bluetooth. People think Bluetooth is for the elder or for the young. Yeah. It's not. Many people break their hips trying to answer the phone. You can go to somebody's room, you know, and they'll have six phones, one in the bathroom, one by their bed, one by the chair they sit in. All they have to do is keep that phone with them, and the phone rings, they answer it. Bluetooth is wonderful for the elderly because they don't have to rush to answer the phone.
That's I never actually thought about that.
A lot of people don't.
That's a pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Speaking of cell phones, you know, maybe it's not mythology or it's urban legend that cell phones, you know, everybody attached to them, almost hermetically sealed to certain kids, will impact hearing loss. Is that true based upon your experience?
Boy, I don't worry about, it's not iPods.
Yeah.
That's what I worry about. iPods become hazardous. Not so much when they're listening in quiet, but it's once you get on the bus and you try to turn it up to override the background noise. That's when you have the noise.
It's like
exposure.
The subways in New York when you can ride the subways and you'll hear three people away what they're listening to.
That's when it's a noise exposure. Yeah.
We're speaking with Dr. Judith Curtin, the doctor of audiology and the owner of the ABC Hearing Net on Boomer Generation Radio. We'll be right back with Dr. Curtin. In a minute, I just want to remind you that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall Outreach, serving the field of aging by raising public awareness and advocacy around important issues of older adults. Through education, training, and implementation of comprehensive approaches to safe, individualized long-term care practices, Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approach to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, government agencies, and related organizations since 1989. And to learn more, visit Kendall.org. That's, again, KENDAL.org. And click on Outreach. We're very pleased to, again, talk about Boomer Generation Radio's affiliation with the Kendall Corporation. I was down there at the corporate offices yesterday, Bill and Beryl were gracious hosts, and it's a great facility, and they do great work. So again, that's the Boomer, that's the Kendall Outreach Program, KENDAL.org, their website, and click on Outreach, And again, their number, their toll-free number for information is 888-759-0128. Dr. Judith Curtin, doctor of audiology and the owner of abchearing.net, professor at Westchester University. We're speaking with Dr. Curtin here on Boomer Generation Radio, just off the topic of Bluetooth-enabled hearing aids, which I think is really, really, really cool. I've heard a lot, and I'm sure you in your practice heard a lot about these cochlear implants.
Right.
So what is that?
I've been involved with cochlear implants in the 80s when they were still experimental.
So what is that?
It's basically let's go back to anatomy a little bit. There's four parts to your ear. There's your outer ear, which is just where your wax would grow, your cerumen. There's the middle ear, which is responsible for aeration. You run into trouble with your middle ear when you're flying. Then there's your cochlea. That is your organ of hearing. That's where all your hair cells are located. When you reach the limits of what a hearing aid can do, when you're getting like less than 30% of sentences and amplification is really not helping you at all, what they do is they go in and they thread. The cochlea looks like a little snail. They thread a little electrode array through the cochlea, and it stimulates the auditory nerve itself and sends the electrical impulse to the brain through the normal pathway that the hair cells that are diminished would normally do. It's more like, you know, those pictures, those pixel pictures, when you back off, you can see that it's a collection of, it's a portrait, but when you're close up, it's just a little picture of little pictures. It's pixel hearing. So it's not as rich and beautiful as what you hear, but tell that to a child who's born, once they get their implants at a year, by kindergarten, you would never know that child was deaf unless you took that implant off them. Now, when I love implants. I have met one person, and I've dealt with a lot of implants. I've only met one person who didn't like their implant, and that person was an adult person who was deaf their entire life. So the implant didn't work for them. But for those people, you were asking about a 90-year-old, what I thought about the quality of life. You know, with 90, you don't know if you're going to be that one that's going to be 102 or 105. It restores you. It restores communication. And that's what separates us. That's what makes us so rich in life. Communication, when it breaks down with hearing loss, is, as you know, is horrible. When your parents can't hear or your family can't hear, you don't even like to talk to them because it's so much work. And that communication is felt by every hearing impaired person, that stress. Cochlear implants restore communication. And that's all of these apparatuses are about restoring communication. They're fabulous. Are they as clear as you and I speaking? No, they don't have the rich lower tones. But will they restore clarity? You'll have a lot of clarity. Interesting enough, when a person first gets their cochlear implant, they can't tell a male voice from a female voice because it restores most of the consonants. It doesn't restore the vowels as much. And vowels is what gives speech its richness and warmness.
In what way? I've never heard that.
I'm academic.
No, that's
and
okay.
If we go down
vowels,
this, we'll...
Vowels, say that again, vowels.
It's like the treble and the bass in your stereo.
Yeah.
If you turn up the bass, you know, mm-hmm. you have the warm and the beats and the...
So somebody getting a cochlear implant really at the beginning can't distinguish between those tones or the vowels, the vowel tones?
The vowels are harder for them to hear, but the consonants come in. But consonants give the clarity to speech and the meaning to speech.
Is there still a controversy in the hearing impaired community with cochlear implants?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that because I was just talking with my students. I think it's less and less.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly, when I was involved in the 80s, it was horrible. It was just, I worked with one child and I felt like I was playing Solomon. You know, it was like, is this worth it to this child's well-being? It was, but it really was not nice. And that's years ago, 25 years ago. Cochlear implants have transformed deaf education. I think there's more of a respect for those people who are born deaf and choose ASL as their primary language.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't
ASL
think,
being American Sign
American
Language.
American Sign Language. Right. The language. It's the naturally evolved language of people who are deaf. And there are huge communities that are very fluent in ASL and families. You know, but 90% of children who are born deaf are born to hearing parents.
Right. Yes.
And yes. ASL is like any language. Once you're an adult, it is very difficult to acquire a second language. Kind of like if you were a child, were born deaf, and you had to learn Russian to talk with them. You know, it's not going to happen. You're not going to be fluent. You don't have enough models around you, or and you're busy and you're working and you're raising a family. So your level of communicative competence is going to be quite diminished if that's the only language your child can access.
One of the other issues I've heard from boomers dealing with their hearing and certainly dealing with their parents is something called tinnitus.
Oh, tinnitus.
Tinnitus. Okay, yeah, some Philadelphia accent.
No, tinnitus and tinnitus are acceptable. It's like either and either.
Okay,
tomato,
so
tomato.
In from my old neighborhood, would that was once described to me as like a ringing in the ear. Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Is that
it's
else?
Any sound in the ear. It can be a ringing. It can be a roaring. It can be a clicking. It can be a pulsing. So it's anything that bothers you.
And where does this come from? And how prevalent is it?
It's very prevalent.
Oh, okay.
It's very, very prevalent.
It's not inevitable, is it?
No, no, it's not as inevitable. And it's not always disturbing either.
Uh-huh.
It's when it becomes disturbed. Well, sometimes it's a sign of cardio issues.
Really?
Yes. The pulsing is more cardiovascular issues. The high blood pressure can cause ringing.
But I know people who...
Noise exposure will cause ringing. That's a sign of damage to your hair cells.
Oh,
aspirin causes ringing.
Really?
Almonds makes my ears ring away.
Almonds?
Almonds, yeah. So allergies can cause... a dental malocclusion can cause ringing. So when you have tinnitus and it's bothering you, you really need to work with somebody who looks at you holistically.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can figure out. They usually end up first with the audiologist, but you do have to look at the whole person. Lyme's disease can cause tinnitus. You really have to rule out. It's a question of ruling out. And then treatment varies by the severity of it. The severity has to do with how much does it bother you. As long as you've ruled out all medical problems, a tumor can cause tinnitus. Yeah. So you have to rule out that all the time. Then you manage it with masking the noise and therapy to teach you how not to focus on it.
Is it just somebody, sometimes you just say, just deal with it, live with it, unless it's really overwhelming?
Often you have to live with it, but there's ways to cope with it. You know, as a counselor, you know that, I'm trying to think of the term that now that they use with like being in the here and now. What's that type of?
Being present, you mean?
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
And
but
not,
this is just not, but it's not the normal. Like if somebody, we were talking before in the first segment about exercise, and somebody works out and they're exercising, and they may then stop and they'll literally hear their heartbeat, and then it'll just disappear.
Well, that's just eustachian tube. Yeah,
yeah, they just, okay.
Yeah. So that's nothing. But exercise, heart disease, and hearing are interrelated.
How?
The heart pumps the blood. That feeds all the microvessels, and the microvessels to the ear are the stria vascularis. And as your heart weakens, your peripheral arteries are the first to weaken.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to starve your ear for the oxygen and the energy and food that it needs. So exercise, you know, go out and do it.
It's amazing. Every time we have a conversation with anybody from the medical field, it comes back to this fact that everything, I try to teach my students this as well, everything is interrelated.
It is.
It's just amazing that this holistic approach, but everything, I mean, the heart, the hearing, everything is in the body is interrelated. The mind, the body, the soul, the stress, the non-stress, it's just fascinating. And yet we're still persisting in many times in a medical system where everything is isolated.
Right. And you can't treat somebody as an isolated person. I mean, that's what I was saying to you, the hearing aid and the cochlear implants, they're bridges to communication.
Mm-hmm.
They're just a small part. I don't know how much more time we have, but I would like to explain hearing loss at a kind of a simplistic level so that people can understand.
We have about 3 minutes, so go for it.
I'll do it very quickly. the typical hearing loss of most people, and I would say 90% of the aging population, and when I say aging, I'm talking 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, okay, is that if you can think of hearing as a piano keyboard, you retain your ability to hear middle C very, very well. But as you go up on the register to the right, your hair cell, the intensity for those sounds to be heard, you have to bang harder with your right hand than your left hand. So the consonants are up on the right side of the piano. So when people say, you know, how are you, when they have a hearing loss, they only hear the left hand saying, how are you, the vowels.
Mm-hmm.
What hearing aids do is they provide the amplification of the upper register and even off your hearing. So it fills in the details that are missing. And it does it beautifully nowadays. So that's a real quick analogy.
Summary of
and when
hearing.
People say what, when people are hearing impaired, they'll say what. And as soon as somebody says what, we talk loud. And then they're, don't talk so loud I can hear, because you're banging on middle C.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts their ears.
Should somebody get a hearing test every year as part of their annual physical?
No, but 5 years.
5 years.
But now once they start having declining hearing, I'm 62, and I've got one frequency that's a little iffy, but I teach, and I'm in a very listening environment. I'm sure I'm going to be in hearing aids within the next 2 years, but that's early. My needs are different than your needs might be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a psychiatrist certainly needs to be in a hearing aid before somebody who's working at an IT job
right. And
doesn't have to interact. So it's really about what are your communication demands dictates when you get amplification
when
you're ready.
We've been speaking with Dr. Judith Curtin, the owner of ABC Hearing Net. That's in
Westchester.
In Westchester. I was just going to ask you where you're located.
Yeah.
Doctor of audiology. Somebody wants to real fast in the minute we have, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, where do you have a website? Or
I do. It's ABC Hearing Net. And you can, you know, send me something through the web. It's
abchearing.net or just ABC Hearing Net?
Well, it's our website. It's abchearing.net.
.net, okay.
And it's Dr. Curtin. And
thank you.
My email is the same, info@jcurtin@abchearing.net.
This is a reminder that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio today has been brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Together, we are transforming the experience of aging. And again, a reminder that to learn more about Kendall, which is K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit Kendall.org or call toll-free at 888-759-0128. Dr. Judith Curtin, I want to thank you very much for being a guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. I wish you much joy and happiness and good hearing. And the word inevitable will stay with me all day. So thank you very much for being a guest. To all of you, we'll see you next week on Boomer Generation Radio. Thank you for joining us.